This is The Big Web Show, episode number 25, Everything Web That Matters. This show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. This episode is brought to you by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. You can sign up for a free account, lets you store 1,000 subscribers and send up to 6,000 emails a month. And now MailChimp has teamed up with everybody's favorite designers to create stunning email templates anyone can use. Go check them out at MailChimp.com/5x5. We're also sponsored today by Typekit. That's right, the easiest way to use real fonts on your website. After years of struggling with Flash and image replacement, we've all been there. You can now rely on CSS3 to use the fonts we all know and love. With a Typekit subscription, you'll have access to over 4,000 fonts for just a few bucks a month from houses like Adobe, Process, FontFont, and more. And it's 100% compatible, web standards compliant, iPhone, iPad, Android, it all works. Go check them out, typekit.com. Hello, Jeffrey Zeldman.
Hello, Dan. And
how are
you? I got to say, what a sales pitch.
If you don't sign up for MailChimp and Typekit after listening to that stuff, what can I say? I failed.
It would be bizarre.
It would be bizarre. Well, happy Halloween almost.
Yeah, I'm going to miss Halloween this year.
Are you?
I'm going to be flying to San Diego.
Oh, wow. For an event apart?
Exactly. So I'm happy about that. Yeah. But I'm missing my daughter's sixth Halloween.
Oh, wow. What are you going to do? Work calls. You are in demand. Yeah. And speaking of people in demand, we have an amazing guest today that you
perhaps, do indeed. Yeah. We do indeed. Karen McGrain keeps a low profile in our community, but she has touched and shaped almost everything that we know on the web.
Well, only the good parts.
Yeah, the good parts. There you go. She is the designer of the New York Times website. She's worked on a whole bunch of wonderful content and publishing sites. She is taught, like half the people that I've worked with are your alumni. They worked for you at Razorfish. I think you set up the first IA division of a web company at Razorfish back in Web 0.1.
Yep, I was the first information architect hired at Razorfish back when all we had was card catalogs.
Exactly, and you're a managing partner at Bond Art and Science and lots more. So, hello.
Hello. Hi, Dan. Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show. Great to have you here. And, you know, I think there's so many things. When I was talking to Jeffrey, he comes up with all the great guests that we have. And he's not kidding when he says you have a low profile. I mean, I'd heard of you, but until I actually read what you'd done, she did that too. So that's kind of crazy. Why such a low profile when you've done so many amazing things? Is that intentional?
I think, you know, I come from Minnesota. I have Scandinavian roots. I think there's a sort of sense of I shouldn't try to call too much attention to myself. I'm working on it. Jeffrey's quite inspirational in terms of convincing me that I got to get out there a little bit more and talk about what I'm doing. I will say I was really lucky to work at Razorfish for 10 years and got a chance to work with so many amazing people there. And I think a lot of my focus was really on internal management and, you know, hiring people, training people, trying to win new clients. When you work at a big agency like that, there actually isn't a lot of incentive to have a high public profile because everything there is so internally focused. But I think I was pretty well liked in the agency.
You were kind of like, well, my brother's this way in the drum world. I think if you ask almost any drummer in the world, they know Pete Zeldman and they know someone who studied with him or something like that. Mm-hmm. But he's never going to be, well, I don't know about never, but he's not somebody that you're going to see on the Grammy Awards and ask the average, like even hardcore music fan, they probably haven't heard of him. He's a drummer's drummer. And to some extent, you're, I would say an IA's IA or a designer's designer, but at this point, you're more like a user experience designer's user experience design. That's hard to say. So I don't know, but you're a mentor. You've mentored a lot of people.
Call me a cult favorite.
Or another way of looking at it, like the writing teacher at Iowa whose students all publish short stories in the New Yorker.
That is an extremely flattering comparison.
But that's who you are. I mean, you have really turned out some of the biggest names and smartest people. I mean, you hired the smartest people, that some of the smartest people I've ever known or worked with, and then you trained them, and then you sent them on their way.
Well, that one of the first things that you learn as a manager is that you should hire people who are smarter than you are, and that was easy for me to do. So, no, I mean, I was really successful and really lucky to be able to attract or find or connect myself with people who are so talented and so smart. And it doesn't surprise me to see what amazing things everybody's gone on to do. In many cases, other people you haven't heard of, like my good friend of mine, Marcelo Maurer, is now running user experience at the BBC. I got to work with Dan Rome when he worked at Razorfish. And, you know, if there was ever a guy who I said, like, that guy is going to go on and do some really fantastic stuff, it was Dan.
Well, who else should we be looking for? Who else is doing amazing stuff that we've never heard of?
Who else is doing amazing stuff we've never heard of? A friend of mine, Stephen Turbeck, runs user experience at Morgan Stanley. And he and I talk a lot about the sense that New York doesn't have the same level of technology industry that maybe the West Coast does. And that's just because there's this whole, like, you know, undersea work that's done in the technology industry. I'm sure if you look at what's done, the amount of development that's done on Wall Street, it eclipses anything that's done in the Valley. But, you know, they never talk about it. It's all done internally. It's all proprietary. So, but, you know, Stephen's doing great things over at Morgan Stanley, and it's been fun to watch him build that team and talk about what it's like to bring user experience into, you know, a very large, slow-moving financial services organization.
Got to be very challenging indeed. Yeah. Let me ask you, because I'm the same way. I hire people who are much better than me, and I don't feel threatened by it. I just sort of bask in there. They're like a warm bath that I get to take every day. But
yeah, you're lucky, right? I mean, right. That's what you like about your opportunities in life, is to have a chance to talk to amazingly smart people, and you get paid for it. It's
right,
great.
Right. But a lot of creative directors and creative team managers feel threatened by that, and you don't seem to have. And I've worked for people who they had to win. They would even give you a bad strategy if necessary to make sure that, you know, the younger, cooler team was not going to beat them, that they were still, you know, to justify mm-hmm. their larger salary. They yeah. felt that their work had to win. How do you guard against that? You don't have to do that now, right? Are you are you still managing a lot of people?
Yeah, I have probably, you know, a team of some full-time people and a bunch of freelancers that I've worked with. So it's very, you know, it is very different when you have your own firm, because, you know, there isn't that sense of competition. I think for me, I have always really believed that I'm not in the business of promoting myself. I'm in the business of promoting user experience. And, you know, I'm not trying for a bigger piece of the pie for myself. I'm trying to make the pie bigger for everybody. And, you know, what that meant for me in my career is, for example, getting speaking opportunities and passing them off to other people. I did it all the time. And, you know, I believed I should have enough stature to be able to go out and find my own speaking opportunities. If somebody contacted me and said, you know, would you like to come and speak? I would very often say, you know what, I'm not going to do this, but I'm going to send somebody else who works for me. What that means is that everybody gets a higher profile. Everybody learns how to present themselves in that kind of public forum. You know, the company does better because there's more publicity, and it's not the me show. I agree. There are probably other people out there who wouldn't have handled it that way, but I believe that it's a lot better to have a lot more people who are out there talking about user experience or talking about the web, because that's how the whole discipline is going to grow. And that's really what I care about.
Tell us about the, you've been doing this a long time, like Dan and me, you started very young. But tell us about the early days of the web and some of the things you're proud of, some of the achievements or understandings, realizations that you've had in your career.
You know, I started doing this. I actually went to grad school and studied technical communication and I guess what HCI. I taught in the HCI program, and so I think I really was one of the first people who had any sort of academic background in doing this. And what I noticed when I was in school was that it seemed like most of the people, maybe half the people in the PhD program, wound up leaving and going to work on the web. Probably one of the best pieces of advice that anybody ever gave me was my dissertation advisor told me, if there is anything else in the world that you think you can do besides getting a PhD, you should go do that thing because you will make more money and you'll be happier. And by God, he was right. I was extremely fortunate to connect with the guys who started Razorfish. We kind of come from the same small suburbs of Minneapolis. So they're kind of like hometown people. And so I was one of the first people at Razorfish. I was the first person with any sort of information architecture, usability, user experience background hired there. Had a chance to start the department there. Had a chance to start hiring people at a very young age. So that really shaped my point of view. And I think I had to learn a lot of things really quickly. I guess everybody working on the web in those days, like the mid to late 90s, got kind of a crash course in how to run a business or how to manage a department or how to manage a client.
And HTML and CSS and JavaScript. And,
yeah. I mean, you really just had to know everything. And we had to build everything ourselves. There was this sense of, there was such almost desperation from people. It was like, we got to have a website. We got to have a website right now. And there weren't the tools available. There just wasn't the level of expertise. And that meant that I look back on it and it meant that you really had to deal with a lot of frustration from businesses because, you know, these were often experienced, you know, historically successful businesses that were coming and then they had a bunch of 25-year-olds show up. We didn't know that much about the web either because we were all still figuring this stuff out. And you had to deal with a lot of flack from clients that I don't have to deal with anymore. Things have calmed down quite a bit, but you know, I learned some things. Some of the things that I look back on and I almost shake my head, like I can't believe that I did that. I did one of the early sites for the Encyclopedia Britannica, which basically taught me everything there was to know about taxonomy and search. They had the largest taxonomy in the English language. I went on from that and did, do you remember when Disney bought InfoSeek and they decided that they would build a portal called go.com? I went out to LA for a year and did all these meetings with Michael Eisner. I mean, there was this one crazy meeting where I'm like, you know, 27 years old and I'm like in the Disney boardroom with Michael Eisner and Bob Iger and like eight other top Disney executives and I'm like presenting wireframes to them and I just look back on that and I'm like what was this time on the internet? How did that happen?
That's just crazy. I mean, one of the things that I think about during that time, like you mentioned, it was just such a weird time and those people, especially the higher up people, it was like they were dealing with this hot coal that they didn't know how to handle. And the mm-hmm. only people that did were these young kids. And they just said, well, we'll just bring them in. They'll make something work. But it doesn't feel like that anymore, especially with what's going on in publishing. This is something that we've talked a lot about on this show, but I'd love to hear your take because you've seen the internet mature and you've really had your hands in it. Where do you sense things are headed now as far as this new publishing revolution, devices like the iPad, the mobile web? I mean, all of these things are finally starting to congeal a little bit. How does that work? And how does Flash figure into all this? Because I know that's something that's on everybody's mind right now.
Yeah, I work with publishers a lot and I do work with financial services companies and some healthcare companies really doing product design. We don't do marketing stuff. We do things that people use. I think in publishing in particular, you're going to continue to see the loss of attachment to traditional brands and traditional publishing models. I probably get a call from a publisher like once a week asking about, should we build an iPad app? You know, can you come in and talk to us about the iPad app? And honestly, I when I started getting those calls, I generally just turned them down. You know, I'm not in the business of taking somebody's $25,000 and building them an iPad app in 3 weeks. That goes really counter to everything that I believe. And you know, then I started actually going in to talk to them to just say, let's talk about what your strategy is here. Let's talk about what you expect to achieve from this, and if it's actually going to make sense. And you know, most of the time, I think it's just them grasping at, you know, a publishing model that just doesn't exist anymore. I don't think people want to download heavy bloated apps onto their iPad. I don't think people have the same attachment to publishing brands as they used to. I don't think people want to read a magazine in the same way that they used to. And so my sense of these publishers right now is that they're just desperately trying to get some attention in the hopes that they can, you know, shore up their revenue a little bit. It remains to be seen what will happen with advertising on the iPad and whether advertisers will consider it to be a worthwhile buy. My money's on probably not. I think they'll realize that it just doesn't have the reach that the web does. And I don't, if you've got $25,000 to spend, are you going to spend it on an iPad app to help reach, you know, 1% of your market? Or are you going to, why not put that $25,000 into your website and, you know, use web standards to make it viewable on the iPad? You know, aggregate your ad sales and aggregate your audience and, you know, make a better experience for the largest number of people possible.
You know, I don't know if you happened to catch the show where we talked to Roger Black, but he made exactly the same points. That's what he also has a, you know, really deep background in dealing with publications and he's building this platform, Tree Saver, that's really CSS, JavaScript, and HTML. Mm-hmm. I told him if we'd come up with it, we would have made it an article on a list apart. Instead, he made it a product. But it's he's created, you know, he and his partners are creating, you know, content platforms based on web standards, and it does make a whole lot more sense. But if people aren't attached, I know this isn't your problem to solve, and I think we're all grateful that it isn't our problem to solve, but if people are losing their attachment to a brand, if they don't really care whether that article came from The New Yorker or The Economist or what, they don't really care, they're just interested in a piece of content, how, yes, they can use Google to find that content if it's on the web, but how does an organization congeal around writers and content and stories if not in this traditional format, right? If there isn't the model of we have a million readers and they each pay $5 an issue and we have advertisers and that's all gone. So the fact that I might get a whole bunch of eyeballs for a particular article one day, that's not a sustainable model, is it? I mean, what do they do? I've expressed the question badly, but do you have any?
Yeah. I think one of the things that I have talked to user experience people about for a while is how to wrap their heads around the advertising business model and, you know, why it's important to at least understand how that works so that we can, you know, hopefully be part of the solution. I mean, I want writers to get paid and I want content, you know, to be considered valuable. Maybe not. I don't think we're ever going to get back to the halcyon days of you know, big expense account lunches and you know, lavish payments to writers that all came from really classified revenue and revenue for publications that, you know, just the bottom's fallen out on. But I think user experience people really do tend to hate ads, and just I've been in a lot of meetings, and you know, frankly, I hate ads too, and you know, have gotten my ass handed to me a couple of times by clients, you know, who really had to explain to me like, hey, this is how we make money, so quit bitching about how many ads we have to have on this page, and you know, so I think figuring out how that's going to work, how we're going to either supplement, you know, how are we going to shore up the ad market and, you know, bring higher CPMs or just, you know, higher value to the type of advertising that we put online is one component of it. I think that means that the publishing industry and the advertising industry just have to catch up to changes in user behavior and start valuing valuing impressions online a little more heavily, and I value print impressions less so. But I think there have to be other revenue models too. So you think about, how do you find articles that you want to read now? Often it's going to be through Twitter or Facebook, or, you know, some kind of referral source from your friends. What happens if publishers sign up with Facebook or sign up with Twitter? And, you know, for every reader that one of those sites sends their way, there's some kind of revenue share. I look at it, and one of the things that's frustrating to me is, I think there are some of the best minds in this industry right now are trying to figure out, how do we monetize this stuff? I mean, this is not a problem that you and I are just stumbling on here in our conversation and going, oh, yeah, maybe we should figure out how to make money off of this thing, right? I mean, everybody is trying to sort this out. And when you get right down to the business model that everybody keeps coming back to, like, what's Twitter doing? Oh, guess what? It's ads. And not making money. So
Facebook's still losing money.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's like everybody's been so desperate for Twitter to come up with a business model, you know, or articulate their strategy for a revenue model for so long. And then, you know, they finally start announcing things, and what is it? Oh, it's advertising. Wow. Well,
and Karen, think about, you know, recently there was an article, I think it was in Wired online, talking about the current fate of Dig. You know, this is a company that was heralded as the poster child for a successful Web 2.0 story. And, you know, and now where are they? I'm not saying they can't pull out of that potential death spiral, but things are certainly changing. One of the questions here, asked by Vasocrata in the chat room, the listener chat room, they said, do you see an issue with leveraging the idea that content producers should get paid, and the fact that access to the internet alone actually costs users a decent amount per month already?
Ah, interesting question.
You know, the carriers are, I think, the worst sort of Soviet style bureaucracy that we have. I mean, is if the questioner is asking, like, do I think we, you know, in my perfect world, would we disintermediate the cable companies and the phone companies? Well, yes. I wish we could see changes to the way that regulation works, or the way that people pay for phone and internet service. Yes, that would be, the world would be a better place. But no, I don't. Obviously, this is like a multi-tier system. It's like, yes, you have to pay for the internet. Yes, you have to pay for the hardware. And then, yeah, somebody has to pay for the content. And either it's going to be, it's like, there are really only like three revenue models out there, right? I pay, you pay, or they pay. The they pay model of having an advertiser pay for the content, and then, you know, you get to read something, and the advertiser pays for you. It's loathsome when you look at a page that's all cluttered up with ads. But if the alternative is you have to pay for that article yourself, maybe the ads don't seem so bad.
You know, Karen. There's a couple of, you touched on a couple of issues. One is, I think the problem with advertising on the web is just that we're it's often done in it's like diarrhea.
It's
the ads
terrible.
Just rip out onto the page, and it's horrible. But it can be done in an intelligent way, in a considered way. And advertisers actually have a huge leg up, as you know, on the internet over advertisers on TV. Advertising on TV is, you know, you don't know if the person watching is a junkie or nursing a baby or junkie nursing a baby. You don't know what's going on. But with on the internet, I mean, you're privy to some pretty, in the people that you deal with, haven't you come across some like really scary information about how much advertisers actually know about us?
Don't even get me started. Yeah. They know everything.
I'd like to get you started. Yeah. I mean, tell us about that.
When I worked at Razorfish, we went through any number of mergers and acquisitions, and eventually got merged with a company called Avenue A, which was the services division of a product called Atlas. And Atlas was the server that basically serves all the ads. And that got sold to Microsoft, and rightly so. I think the guys who invented that saw a real need in the marketplace, developed a great product, and you know really deserved to have that product be successful. But what I, you know, what I learned from working with those guys is it is amazing the amount of data that they have, not personally identifiable data about you, but you know what they know about your computer because they work with so many different advertisers or work with so many different publishers. They have a lot of aggregate data about your demographics, about your browsing behavior, and you know they can use that information to target ads to you. And for somebody for somebody who's working in content and saying, wow, wouldn't it be great if on the user experience side we could do a much better job of personalizing this information for the reader and you know target things a little bit better? And then you look at what they can do on the ad side, and it's just like, you know, we're lucky if we can serve up a couple different, you know, tailored messages on the homepage. And they're like, oh, well, you know, we can do whatever you want. If you only want to show this to women in Seattle who have never bought a car before, fine, we can do that.
They know on my computer if I visit large Russian ladies' websites, right? They don't know my name, but they know my IP address, and they know everything that I've seen.
Yeah.
And they can then orchestrate content. And you're right, we're fumbling around in this like 19th century haze, and they're already with, actually the advertisers are even, they used to say porn drives everything. Right, the porn starts the industry, but you know they started video and they were on the internet first. But I think advertising, really, as hated as it is, advertisers really know everything. And so if I were an advertiser with looking for men who've never bought a car, I would want to use the internet, and that seems like a hopeful thing for people who make content.
I'm always reminded of the movie with Tom Cruise, which for whatever reason, every time I try to talk about it, I can't remember.
Minority Report.
Thank you.
I can never remember the name either.
In that movie,
unless you do it,
you know, you're recognized basically by anywhere you go. It scans your retinas and it knows who you are, and it offers something to you that's customized. And some of the people in the chat room were saying, I actually prefer ads that are targeted to me. I would, and I think that's true. I would rather see ads that reflected the interests, whether they're previous purchases or things like that. I'm not necessarily fond of all of that information sharing that might be going on behind the scenes, but if it creates, you know, I'd rather never see an ad for something I'm never going to use and actually see an ad for a cool new t-shirt from ThinkGeek over, you know, something for, you know, automotive repairs. You know, the one of it's going to appeal to me, one is not.
Here's the problem. Think about if you are the person who is out, if you work for a client, let's say you're the brand manager at Procter & Gamble, and your job is to buy advertising services.
Right.
What you know how to do is buy TV commercials. And, you know, that's all you've ever had. You know, you spent 10, 15 years working, you know, in various businesses, and all you do is buy TV commercials. And you know, if you keep buying TV commercials, you're not going to get fired. No one's going to question your decision to buy TV commercials. And, you know, people go in and they try to sell the promise of digital. And, you know, these people don't know how to buy it. And there's a real timidity, I think, around experimenting because it may not deliver the same results and they might get fired. So when they do buy digital, what do they buy? They buy TV commercials on the internet. So that's where you get flash microsites from.
Yeah, that's all true, but it will change. It's, you know, they used to say nobody ever got fired for buying Microsoft or for recommending Microsoft, and now in some cases people do get fired from recommending Microsoft. I mean, things do change over time. I totally agree with you. There's a lot of people who in advertising right now, in sales and so forth, who are going to have to find a work somewhere else, like the auto industry. Oops, not that either. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do.
Maybe
it's
Wall
interesting.
Street.
There we go, because there's still money there. If you have any privacy concerns, you actually get bad ads. So there's an inducement to reveal more about yourself. For instance, on Facebook, I decided I didn't want to say whether I was liberal or conservative or how liberal or how conservative. So under politics, I just wrote love, right? Because that's my politics. I did the same with religion, right? Religion, love. Politics, love. I think that's actually a true statement. That's the kind of politics I would like. I don't know where it's going to come from, but yeah. So now I get ads for frothing right-wing and left-wing politicians, and I keep saying, no, I'm not interested in this, but they keep showing it to me because I didn't predefine myself as a category. And mm-hmm. if I had said, oh, I'm ultra-liberal, then I'd be seeing pictures of whoever that is, and I'd be going, oh, I'm happy because, I'm not seeing a politician I dislike. So, there are inducements for users to tap in, and it's weird, too, because I think a lot of times people think it's fun or a game. I'm filling out my profile, and it's like, mm-hmm. no, actually, you're holding your wallet out the window, waving it at an advertiser. That's really what you're doing. But for me, I mean, I know about what's happening, and I worked in advertising before the internet, and I'm a sucker, and I'll go, oh yeah, I got to write down all the movies I like and all the music I like and what authors I like, and it's like, yeah, so that they can sell you the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. That cheers me up.
So how do we instigate change? How do we inspire this change? Is it simply a matter of the people who are in their 20s, 30s, and maybe 40s now coming into power, and the people who are, of that old guard finally retiring and stepping down? Is it going to take that?
I think that's part of it, but I think we have to do a better job of, I think, articulating the values of the world and how those values have changed. Because I do think we're kind of in this transitional space where, there's still this value of what we should do is we should put, glossy flash microsites on the internet. Because that's what we know how to do and that's what we think people want. I think people who do work on the web and do have some sense of what user behavior is like online and, how that has changed and what that means for marketers, I think we have to talk about it more. So, I have tried to tell people for years, like, your metadata is your marketing. Your ability for people to, find you, search for you, to be able to categorize yourself at a very fine level of detail, is going to be crucial for what you consider marketing to be over the next decade. I can remember being in meetings with creative directors where I can seriously remember sitting there and trying to talk about the taxonomy and having the creative director just start laughing like, oh, taxonomy. Like, I'm embarrassed that you would even say that word in front of me. And it's like, well, guess what? Welcome to the web.
Speaking of content, another thing I wanted to talk about with you is the frenzy over content management systems, right? Content applications. And again, sort of grabbing, you're talking about publishers desperate and grabbing the wrong end of the bull.
Mm-hmm.
I guess both ends of the bull are actually the wrong. I wouldn't really want either end, but forget my metaphor. Grabbing the wrong end of the tool.
They're both wrong for very different reasons.
And you know what? Grabbing the wrong end of the tool, that doesn't really help us either. Grabbing the wrong end of something. With content management systems, you have told me that you feel the same thing is happening, that it's actually not a problem about technology, that it's a problem about content. Did you want to, would this be a good place to talk about that?
Yeah, I love to, I get all wound up about this particular subject. I do a lot of work with, not just with publishers, but, with other types of businesses that now have to implement a publishing workflow. They're in the business of generating content regularly. Like, they're a financial services company, or they're a retail company, or they're a travel company, and they've decided that they need to be generating content on a regular basis to keep their name in front of their audience, which is a great strategy. And when you talk to people, one of the first things that you discover is how inefficient and painful the content management system is, that they have implemented a package, oftentimes based on technical architecture. Their decision was made by their technical architecture, or their decision was made based on features, quote unquote features, you know, some IT person had a checklist of things that they thought they wanted. And no one ever sat down and said, well, what is the experience going to be like for the content administrator, like the CMS monkey, I have to refer to them as sometimes, that whose job it is to sit there all day and operate this thing. And it's terrible. And it's so inefficient. And it really speaks to this idea that we don't think of, you know, our internal resources and our internal time as a valuable business asset. And that if you can reduce the number of steps it takes someone to manage or edit the content, or if you can put in automated tools to make it easier for you to find and edit and keep content fresh, that kind of efficiency makes your business more successful. And so instead, we just have these terrible tools. I mean, you know, when I talk to people at conferences, it's like, you just get people coming up to you like zombies, like, help me, I'm locked in the basement and my job is to navigate through 17 screens every time I need to upload a piece of content, and can you help me? And, you really wonder, like, this isn't just me, you know, feeling sorry for people and saying like, oh, wow, your job sucks. This is me saying, this is not efficient for your business. And you know, you could be producing so much more and better content and be more successful in your initiatives if only the tools that people had to use worked better.
Well, it seems like if we started with content strategy, and we recently did an article on this on List Apart, if you start mm-hmm. with content strategy and then design your system, that's going to make a lot of sense. But what we start with instead is an entrenched IT department that's standardized on IE6 and, you know, they have all these trained dot. I mean, I've had people say when we were trying to move them to like a $100 content management system that we could then work with to give it to make it work exactly the way they wanted to. Guy saying, but I have all these engineers on staff who know .NET and they don't know LAMP and they can't work with Expression Engine or whatever. And yeah. Are you saying I should just get rid of these employees? It's like they sort of make it. You try to help them with their business, and their answer is, I don't want to get rid of my employees, or I myself am unqualified to run the department that you envision me, you know, so, and my answer would be, well, you're probably not unqualified. You just need to let go of some things and learn some new things. But yeah, it's very tough. It's like cleaning up Washington, right? There's just so much entrenched power that no matter who comes at it and says, here's a better idea, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to be persuasive. Because, like, if you're trying to take my house away from me, it's not persuasive to me.
I think those kind of entrenched power relationships, it's like, well, this is my job. How can you, you know, my job is to know how to work this CMS. So what happens if you take that away from me? I've dealt with a client recently that had that exact problem. But I think in a bigger sense, I sometimes think of CMS as like the enterprise software that user experience forgot. We would never tolerate this level of inattention for the user and inefficiency in lots of other enterprise applications. Or, you know, you would go in and say, no, we have to understand the workflow and we have to think about the people first and we have to, you know, try to create a process that's manageable. And instead here, there's just the sense of like, oh, well, we design the front end and, you know, somebody else, I guess, is thinking about what has to happen in the CMS, or you say, can the CMS do this? And somebody says, yeah, the CMS can do that. And it's like, yeah, it can do that. But the process by which it does that is horrific. You know, you don't want to do that. And you know, I think if organizations sat down and said, let's map out our editorial processes first, you know, in that like Jonathan Cahn's article, which I think he's fantastic for talking about this subject and for writing that for A List Apart, map out the administrator experience first. Let's talk about what has to happen on the back end to make different things possible on the front end, and make sure that whatever we design can be supported in a humane fashion for the administrators. And that's just user experience 101. Like we can do this, guys.
That's very inspiring. what are you actually doing in your company now that's related to this or unrelated to this? What kind of work do you actually get, and what kind of work do you look for?
I have been recently trying to talk to more companies about this exact problem. So working, I've worked with a couple of clients, smaller clients recently, or, you know, on relatively small engagements, but strategy projects to go on and say, let's talk to your editorial team. Let's map out your workflow. Let's identify what the pain points are. Let's talk about, you know, ways to resolve those pain points and then put together a strategy for how we could move forward. So sometimes that means offline things, you know, better communication processes or, you know, better ways to work internally or just, you know, better internal flows. Sometimes that means redesigning the CMS interface. You know, sometimes that means tearing the entire CMS out and starting over. I do a lot of work with Drupal. And, you know, I know Drupal gets a bad rap for, you know, having every feature and, you know, every possible thing that anyone's ever wanted to do in Drupal, you can do in Drupal. But the reason that I like it is that if you take somebody like me with a content strategy and a user experience background who can come in and say, oh, okay, here's what your editorial team wants. Let's quickly build a screen that just does this. You can do that really quickly. And I think the Drupal developers that I've worked with are thrilled to have, you know, a content-focused user experience person come in and say, oh, okay, out of all of these options, do these things. No one wants to deliver a bad experience. It's just they don't necessarily know, you know, they're not the bridge between the editorial team and the CMS interface. But I can go in and say, oh, okay, here's what your editorial team wants. Here's how you build it on the back end. You know, let's build screens that work like this, and people are happier.
So is this the tie-in with Buzzr?
That, yes. So I did a startup called Buzzr, which was supposed to be a better, more usable front end for Drupal. I did that with a company called Lullabot.
Lullabot.
No, Lullabot, yeah. That was an interesting experience. It was, yeah, I love the people at Lullabot. I don't know if this is the right way to decide to do a startup, but it's either incredibly motivating or incredibly demotivating. But my rationale for going into it was I said, you know what? If I never make any money off of this at all, it will still be worth doing. Just because it'll be a chance to work with these guys, dig into some of these concepts a little bit more, you know, wrap my head around how Drupal works. And so for that, it was incredibly useful to me.
What skills should our listeners who maybe have less experience in this field be cultivating, or what ideas should they be thinking about? If we have a lot of experienced designers, developers, user experience people who listen to the show, but there's also people who are new and who are very, very jazzed about this field, but aren't sure what to study, what to learn. I mean, I get questions all the time. Like, I'll get people saying, should I learn Flash or not? That's a typical question I get asked a lot. What should people be learning if they want to have a meaningful and productive career in interaction design on the web?
Great question.
That's a great question, and one that's incredibly near and dear to my heart. I think for me, probably the most rewarding part of what I do is either getting to talk to people or work with people who are just starting out. I teach at SVA, and you know, I love the fact that this field has grown so much that, you know, now there are lots of different career paths that people can take, or, you know, there is a sense of greater degrees of specialization in the field. I think people who want to get into interaction design or user experience, you know, I think really need a solid foundation in whether it's, you know, behavioral psychology or, you know, just how people read and make decisions about information that they see. So I actually have a background in technical communication, and a lot of what, you know, where I came from an understanding of how people read and, you know, how people, you know, make sense of information that's presented in front of them, like how they filter and how they ignore things and how you get your message across in an environment where people don't care all that much, or they're maybe not paying attention, or, you know, they're not going to take away from what you write the same things that you expected them to. And a lot of that, to me, translated really beautifully to the web, to say, okay, how do you chunk information? How do you label information? How do you categorize things? How do you make things physical or visual for people so that they understand how things work? And so, you know, I think designers out there can definitely find programs that take that sort of theoretical approach to understanding information, whether that's programs like the program at SVA or other HCI interaction design program. I think there one of the flaws of the web is that people do still think of it as technology, and so they, you know, they get caught up in, well, should I learn this program or that program? I remember when I was in grad school, one of my professors, you know, starting out the class and just basically being like, we are not here to teach you tools. Like, if you want to learn a tool, go take a class at a community college where you're going to be paying, you know, a tenth of what the credit hour here would cost. Here, we're teaching you principles and values that will underlie your work, you know, for the rest of your career. You know, that whatever tool you learn right now, whether it's Flash or Director or Shockwave, that's not going to last. But if you develop some foundations in how people think, how people read, how people make decisions, how people make physical choices and translate them into things that they think, that will serve you for the rest of your career.
Wow. Great insight, Karen. Thank you. And we're kind of out of time, but we really appreciate you joining us and sharing all this. I was mentioning to Jeffrey in our host chat that I'm going to need to listen to this again to unpack all this. The density of information of this one was great, and I really appreciate you coming on. I know I speak for Jeffrey too when I say that. Thank you very, very much. Thanks, Jeffrey. Yeah.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Karen. Very, very much.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see y'all again next week. Thanks again to our guest, Karen McGrain. You can visit KarenMcGrain.com or follow her on Twitter at Karen McGrain. And thanks also to MailChimp.com and TypeKit.com for making this show possible. And as always, thanks to you for listening. You can hear previous episodes of this show and learn more about all of the shows we produce by visiting 5x5.tv. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating it on iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find out about the show. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see y'all again next week.